Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. The woman could see a home in the distance, illuminated with Christmas lights. Naked, barefoot, and bleeding from the gunshot wound to her head, she ran a mile through the frozen fields. Each time she saw a car's headlights, she dove down and buried herself in the snow, fearing it would be the kidnappers returning to finish her off. She climbed over barbed wire fences, which tore at her exposed flesh. She was bleeding from her head, body, hands, everywhere. She ran to the nearest door and banged on it with her last bit of energy. It was approximately 2:30 in the morning when the homeowner answered the door. He was shocked at the sight of the bloodied, naked woman on his porch. After the homeowners brought her inside and wrapped her in a blanket, the woman insisted the couple listen to her before calling 911. She was afraid she might die before she could tell them her story. The homeowner called anyway and relayed each sentence to the dispatcher as she described the details of what happened to her. Eventually, she took the phone and spoke directly to the 911 operator. She sobbed and even lost consciousness at one point. Thankfully, she survived and was able to report the entirety of the horrific events of the evening and early morning. When I was reading up on this week's episode, I was surprised to find some law enforcement officials call the murderers in this case, and I quote, "the devil incarnate." In most situations, we try not to use that terminology. So what made this case so tragic that the detectives involved say that it actually changed their life? In December of 2000, brothers Jonathan and Reginald Carr embarked on a crime spree that started with armed robbery and ended in a mass murder. The torture and cruelty that they inflicted on their victims was so depraved that I began to understand why this case so greatly impacted the detectives that worked on it. While there was a mass murder, one woman survived. She was the one who ran to the house bleeding that night. I will call her HG from here on out to protect her privacy. And because she told her story, we know exactly what happened on December 14th. As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is Killer Psyche. Through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse, I've spent decades studying people's minds. I've interviewed many murderers, including serial killers. And the question I get asked time and time again is, why did they do it? I want to give you a satisfying answer to that question. So in this series, I'm diving deep into the mindsets of these criminals to give you my best analysis of what made them do what they did. This episode is the Wichita Massacre. At 10:45 p.m. on December 7, 2000, 25-year-old Andrew Schreiber stopped at a convenience market in Wichita, Kansas, for some quick shopping. He returned to his SUV and was about to put his car in gear when a male in his early 20s approached his driver's side window. He held a small black semi-automatic gun, palm down, that means Hollywood style, and pointed the barrel directly at Andrew's head. The gunman demanded Schreiber move to the passenger seat. As Schreiber complied, the man hit him on the back of his head with the pistol and told him to move faster. He then drove Andrew's vehicle to a nearby alleyway and picked up a second armed man and told Andrew not to look at him. The two gunmen drove Schreiber to two separate ATMs where they forced him to withdraw $800 from his account. As Andrew withdrew the money, the men repeatedly struck him on the head and shouted to not look at them. Having reached the limit on withdrawals from Schreiber's accounts, the gunmen drove to a car wash and one directed the other to wipe down the SUV to eliminate fingerprints. They returned to the alleyway near the convenience store and collected the second gunman's car. With Schreiber still in the back seat of his SUV, the first gunman followed the sedan to a remote rural area. They parked off-road, and the two men joked about taking Schreiber's clothes and leaving him naked in the freezing weather. One gunman fired three shots into the tires and then just threw the keys on the dirt road. Schreiber waited until he couldn't see the sedan's taillights anymore before he climbed out of his car. He located his keys and was able to maneuver his car back onto a paved road. He drove home and called 911. He had caught a glance of the assailants and was able to describe them to the dispatcher. The gunmen, later identified as brothers Reginald and Jonathan Carr, had discovered a new way for them to get easy money. With that in mind, they began to search for more victims. 5 nights later, on December 11th at 9:45 p.m., they found one. Anne Walenta, a cellist with the Wichita Symphony Orchestra, had arrived home from rehearsal and noticed a light-colored sedan following her SUV. Uneasy, she sat in her driveway and waited to see what the driver and passenger in the other vehicle were doing. She watched as a young male exited the sedan and approached her driver's side window. He signaled that he needed her help. When she rolled the window down, he pointed a pistol. Instinctively, she put the car in reverse. The gunman shot through the front windshield 7 times. She was hit by several bullets, one of which severed her spine. The car behind her started to leave, with the gunman fleeing on foot, trying to catch up with him. A neighbor, alerted by the sound of gunfire, opened her front door. Walenta called out to her for help. At the hospital, Walenta was able to give the police a description of her shooter. She said it was, quote, a black male between 5'10 and 6 feet tall, with hair that was about shoulder length. Sadly, 1 month after the shooting, Ann Walenta suffered a pulmonary embolism, a complication from the paralysis caused by her severed spine, and she died. 3 nights later, the two men escalated their violent crime spree. On December 14th, 2000, at around 10:45 p.m., Jan Beck left a restaurant not far from Ann Walenta's home. Beck started driving home when she noticed a car following her. She called her daughter as she approached her condo and asked her to open the garage door. As a precaution, Beck remained in her car until she saw the Toyota pass her home and head back out to the main street. However, the men had turned their vehicle back toward Jan Beck's condo, one of the three units in a triplex. 10 minutes later, they knocked on the front door of the middle unit in the triplex, looking for Beck. However, that door did not belong to Beck. 29-year-old Aaron Sander, one of the three men who shared that unit, turned on the porch lights and opened the door. Realizing that they had knocked on the wrong door, but deciding to improvise, the brothers burst into the home, grabbed Aaron by his shirt, and pointed guns at his head. Moments later, the gunman had pulled Aaron, a divinity student, into a bedroom where Jason Beaufort, a high school science teacher, was in bed with his girlfriend, H.G., an elementary school teacher. The gunman demanded to know if anyone else was in the home. The victims told them their third roommate, 27-year-old Brad Hayeka, was downstairs, and 25-year-old Heather Muller, a friend of Aaron's, was sleeping in the upstairs bedroom. Jonathan and Reginald forced all three of the roommates and two guests into the same bedroom. The brothers then ordered the five hostages to strip naked and push them into the bedroom closet together. That was when the night took an even worse turn. The cars brought H.G. and Heather out of the closet and forced the women to perform sex acts on each other. After that, the brothers removed each of the male roommates individually and ordered them at gunpoint to each rape H.G. and Heather. When one of the men broke down and refused to do it, the gunman struck him on the head with a golf club. The Carr brothers then fell back on their earlier crime. They decided to take Brad's silver pickup truck and take the victims one by one to get money from their bank accounts. After the older brother, Reggie, left with Brad to withdraw more money from an ATM, the horror for the rest of the victims continued. While he waited for his brother to return, Jonathan took H.G. from the closet and raped her, repeatedly. After that, he traded her for Heather and did the same, making certain that everyone in the closet could hear the women screaming. Jonathan then discovered an engagement ring hidden under a bed and demanded to know who it belonged to. Jason had bought the ring for H.G., and this is how she learned that her boyfriend was going to propose on Christmas Day. After taking all their victims one by one to ATM machines and draining their bank accounts, Reginald returned to the house and joined his brother in raping the women multiple times. The forced victim-on-victim sexual abuse and rape continued until midnight. I'm not going to go into further detail because it is one of the most disturbing cases of sexual assault that I have seen in a long time. In fact, that I've seen in my career. And what I have already described to you is horrible enough. When Reginald and Jonathan had decided that they'd had enough, they ordered all five victims, still naked or partially clothed, outside. They forced all three men into the trunk of one of the victims' cars. Reginald then ordered Heather into the passenger seat. The other gunman took HG into Brad's pickup truck. She noted the clock on the dashboard said 2:07 a.m. They drove the victims to a snowy soccer field that was under construction. The brothers moved the women to sit in the car together while they sat in the truck to discuss what to do with their victims. Reginald then unlocked the trunk and ordered the three men to get out and kneel with their backs to the car. Then he had the women kneel beside them. Once they were all lined up, the brothers shot each one, execution style, in the back of the head. When the bullet hit the back of HG's skull, she experienced an explosive pain that numbed all of her other senses. Her vision blurred and she saw white stars. Only later would she learn that her plastic hair clip, something she had put in only minutes before the brothers burst into the home, had deflected the bullet that was meant to kill her. Still conscious, she pretended to be dead. She heard truck doors slam, its engine start, and finally, she felt the weight of the vehicle rolling over her torso. The killers drove the truck over all five victims to make certain that they were dead. When she could no longer hear the truck's engine, HG sat up and reached for her boyfriend. Believing he was still alive, she wrapped her sweatshirt, the only clothing she had, around his head. After seeing that her other three friends were dead, she realized that she was probably dying as well. HG knew she must summon her last bit of strength to recount their horrific story before it was too late. And that is when she began to run naked through the snow towards the Christmas lights. After HG's conversation with the dispatcher, the police and ambulance arrived. She was able to give the police specific details about the killer's physical appearance, the clothes they were wearing, as well as her boyfriend's stolen truck that transported the victims to the soccer field. A sheriff's deputy went to the soccer field and was able to confirm HG's story. Her four friends were all dead, lying face down in the snow. Police were now on the hunt for two armed and highly dangerous murder suspects. Police were able to apprehend Reginald soon after the murders, thanks to a tip from a neighbor. He had recognized a truck in the parking lot as the same one on the TV news. When Reginald was arrested, the police officers found various items belonging to the victims, including a large television, a checkbook, wallets, computer equipment, and jewelry. The officers also found a credit card belonging to HG. They then recovered bank receipts from earlier that morning. The evidence was overwhelming. Meanwhile, Jonathan was at a girlfriend's apartment when news broke that Reginald had been arrested and police were looking for another suspect. The friend and her mother became suspicious, and the mother snuck out and went to a neighbor's. From there, she called the police. The SWAT team arrived and arrested Jonathan. Just like his brother, Jonathan also had the victim's possessions on him, including the engagement ring that was intended for HG. Once again, the evidence was overwhelming. On December 15th, Aaron Schreiber, the first carjacking victim, saw news coverage of Reginald Carr's arrest. Schreiber was certain that Reginald had been the gunman who kidnapped him at the convenience store just a few days earlier, and he let the police know. Before she died, Anna Walenta also identified Reginald Carr in a photo spread as the shooter outside her home. And finally, HG was shown the same array of photos, and she positively identified Reginald Carr as well. With all of this evidence and several positive IDs from multiple victims, the police knew for certain that they had the right culprits of this horrible crime spree.
Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital on sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
Reginald, or Reggie Carr, was born on November 14, 1977, and his brother Jonathan was born about 2 years later in March of 1980. The boys were raised in Dodge City, Kansas, along with their two sisters. After the youngest sister died at 2 years old from leukemia, the family fell apart. The brothers had very different reactions to the death of their sister. Jonathan was said to have cried inconsolably, while Reginald was detached and showed no emotion. After their daughter died, both parents began to drink heavily. They became severe alcoholics and began neglecting their remaining children. Soon after, they divorced. After the father left, Reginald stepped up as a father figure in the family. Their mother was rarely around, so he took care of his brother and sister and formed a very close bond with Jonathan. With no one around to watch them, the brothers had no rules. They began abusing alcohol in elementary school. Alcohol causes the brain to slow down. It is a depressant. Research shows that the earlier a person starts drinking alcohol at harmful levels, the greater the risk of changing the development of their brain. And this can lead to problems with memory and learning. A child's brain continues to develop well into their early 20s. Using alcohol at an early age can negatively impact the child's problem-solving skills. It also affects their performance at school, as well as their body, their mood, and their mental health. According to the National Health and Medical Research Council, two areas are most affected because of the momentous changes they are undergoing at this time. These are the hippocampus, which is responsible for memory and learning. Studies of adolescents show that heavy and extended alcohol use is associated with a 10% reduction in the size of the hippocampus. It also shows the function of the hippocampus is uniquely sensitive to alcohol. Alcohol may also be poisonous to the nerve cells of the hippocampus, causing them to be damaged or even destroyed. And the prefrontal lobe, which is important for planning, judgment, decision-making, impulse control, and language development, is the area of the brain that changes the most during the teenage years. Research with heavy drinking adolescents shows that these young people have smaller prefrontal lobes than young people the same age who do not drink. In fact, at their sentencing, an expert witness for the defense, who was a retired medical doctor, said that both Reginald and Jonathan showed abnormal brains on the PET scan. This type of scan was performed in preparation for the trial. He concluded that the areas of the brain responsible for short-term memory and risk assessment were 50% less active than those of a normal brain. This was backed up by a neuropsychologist who determined that Reggie had suffered, and I quote, significant head trauma sometime in the first 9 years of his life. However, the state's expert witness, a neuroradiologist, countered that the scans showed normal brains. In the end, the defense attorney acknowledged that this evidence did not cause or excuse the crimes that the Carr brothers committed. Not only were the Carr brothers drinking heavily in grammar school, but they also became sexually active. Reginald began having sexual interaction at the age of 6 with girls that his mother was babysitting. This was around the same time that his father abandoned the family and disowned them, a loss that hit Reggie especially hard. By the age of 7, Reginald said that he had sexual intercourse with his female cousin on a regular basis. He had also found pornographic pictures of his mother and stepfather that he kept with him up until the time he was arrested. When Jonathan was 6 or 7, Reginald pushed him to have sexual activity with a girl who was his same age. Reggie would ridicule Jonathan as being weak and attacked his masculinity when he did not do what Reggie wanted him to do. Jonathan worshipped Reginald, so he would go along with anything that his older brother asked of him. I can't imagine any adult thinking it's okay for adolescents, and especially young children, to engage in sexual activity. But let me tell you what happens when it does occur. It can stunt the development of their adult personality, because they skip some of the steps of their normal development. They do not get to have their emotional life evolve in a typical way. Dr. Thomas Reedy, a forensic psychologist who examined Reginald, says that his moral development was stunted and that, quote, children exposed to early sexual activity often have impaired sexual control and are aroused by deviant sexual behavior. During the trial, the sister of the Carrs related information of her childhood rape by their father and the molestation of her and the brothers by their mother's boyfriends. The abuse of the children was ignored by their mother. However, when their mother was angry, she would direct it right at her children. She would have them strip naked and have their siblings hold them down. She would then beat them with a belt or an electrical cord. Notice any similarities here between the treatment of the kids and the kids' eventual treatment of their own victims? The boys took out their rage in different ways. Reggie became violent and aggressive, and he hated everyone except Jonathan. From kindergarten to 8th grade, he had attended 8 schools and was frequently absent. In 8th grade, he was suspended for sexually harassing a teacher. During his freshman year in high school, Reginald Carr had earned 21 detentions and suspensions. After beating up a student, Reginald dropped out of school before the school could kick him out. The neuropsychologist that testified at the trial said that Reggie had developed an antisocial personality disorder, or ASPD, by the age of 5. According to an article in Everyday Health, quote, ASPD is a psychological condition characterized by a lack of empathy and a remorseless disregard for and violation of the rights of others. Nowadays, it is only diagnosed in people 18 and over, but symptoms of ASPD begin in childhood or adolescence. But when children show serious signs of antisocial behavior, they are diagnosed instead with conduct disorder. Not all children with conduct disorder end up developing antisocial personality disorder. All adults with ASPD first showed signs of psychopathy during childhood. So, what are the signs of conduct disorder? 1. Aggression towards people and animals. This includes bullying, threatening or attempting to intimidate others, forcing sexual activity, initiating physical fights, and using weapons. 2. Destruction of property. The child will damage or break others' property and intentionally set fires, not for fun, but to cause damage. 3. Deceitfulness, lying and stealing, breaking into a home, building, or car. 4. Serious rule violations, and this includes actions such as staying out at night without permission or against parental wishes, running away repeatedly, and school truancy that goes well beyond occasionally skipping a class. For this diagnosis, the child needs to have exhibited several of these behaviors over a one-year period. If they have more than 3 of these behaviors, that is a giant sign. The majority of children who have conduct disorder later have ASPD as adults. In the most recent edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, also known as the DSM-5, an additional specifier was added to bring more clarity to a diagnosis of conduct disorder, and that is displaying a lack of remorse or guilt, callousness and lack of concern, and a shallow affect. This describes Reggie. Jonathan, however, internalized his anger and became very depressed. At the age of 7, he attempted to kill himself by hanging. This is very rare for someone this young to attempt suicide. Both brothers had become very detached. Reggie, because he didn't seem to have any emotion other than rage, and Jonathan, because he had too much emotion and could not express it. As the brothers grew older, the boys showed no interest in changing their ways. Reggie joined a gang when he was only 13 and began dealing drugs. He even dealt drugs to his mother. By the age of 16, he was on criminal probation, and by the age of 18, he was in prison. Family members say that Jonathan was very different when Reggie wasn't around. His mother and aunt discouraged him from hanging out with his brother so that he could stay out of trouble. But while Reginald was in prison, Jonathan seemed lost. He would pass the time aimlessly, waiting for his brother to get out of jail. At 16, he unsuccessfully attempted suicide once again, this time by drinking antifreeze. The forensic psychologist that examined him for trial said that Jonathan had the 5 H's: hopeless, helpless, homeless, hungry, and hugless. Both brothers started using drugs at an early age in addition to the alcohol, and Jonathan's prolific use of marijuana did not help his depression. He was finding no joy in anything. The only one that mattered to Jonathan was his brother. While Reggie was in prison, his rage and sexual aggression only grew. When he was released a year later, he had become more violent than when he was first incarcerated. After he and Jonathan reunited, they embarked on a new quest to get money any way they could. This was the beginning of their crime spree. Criminologist Dr. Scott Bond wrote in an article in Psychology Today that, quote, spree killing involves the murder of multiple people at different locations over a short period of time in which there is no cooling off period between the murders. Thus, it is similar to serial murder with one key difference. Spree killers do not come down from the high of their first murder or resume their seemingly normal lives in between killings, such as serial killers do. The maximum duration between murders and spree killing is generally considered to be 7 days. Serial killers, on the other hand, may cool off for weeks, months, and in rare instances, even years between murders. Spree killings are triggered by emotional upheavals and often involve victims who are acquaintances or family of the perpetrator, while serial killings are generally unemotional, driven by long-term and deep-seated fantasies, and involve victims who are unknown to the killer. The value in knowing how spree killers operate lies largely in finding clues for identification and for predicting their next move, finding them, and warning potential victims. Punitive anger is the primary motivator, and the Carr brothers were angry. Although some spree killers do kill randomly, they usually have a mission or a goal. For Reggie, his goal was easy money, and he was certainly angry enough. Armed with a handgun, they moved to Wichita because they believed that there were many wealthy people there to rob. They targeted people who owned big luxury vehicles. When the brothers carjacked and robbed Andrew Schreiber, they spared his life. They had not yet taken that big step towards murder. After the robbery, they went on a spending spree, and they were not at all concerned that they would be caught. The stolen funds only lasted 2 days. But they now knew how they could get more money very easily. After the failed robbery of Ann Walenta, the brothers were desperate for money. They drove around, tailing expensive cars. They did not try to hide. They had no fear that the police were after them or they could be caught. Sociopaths and psychopaths believe that the rules and regulations the rest of us live by is for us. It's not for them. But when sociopaths commit crimes, they tend not to think of the consequences or how to get rid of evidence. And these two guys, they were fueled by anger. When you're angry, you don't think things through. When they once again failed with their attempt to rob Jan Beck, the woman that they followed home and went to the wrong condominium in the triplex, they decided to improvise. This was the beginning of their depravity with strangers. They now focused all their anger and rage on these people. They tortured them and sexually assaulted them in ways that they had been victimized, except this time they were in control. The Carr brothers went beyond that. Forcing the victims to have sex with each other was a way to humiliate them, to show that the brothers had the ultimate control over them. We focused a lot on Reggie being the rageful one, Reggie being the angry one, but let's not forget, when Reggie left the scene to take one victim at a time to the ATM, it was Jonathan, not Reggie, that took the lead in the sexual torture. While Reggie was taking the men to the ATM, Jonathan decided to rape both HG and the other woman. We may not ever know what spurred Jonathan into instigating, for supposedly the first time, a violent act before his brother did. He was usually the follower in the situation, but now he had initiated the violence for the first time. Both brothers had finally crossed a line that they could not come back from. To say that the brothers' actions were sadistic is a profound understatement. They not only sexually tortured the victims, but by making them violate each other, they mentally tortured them as well. After they were caught, the men showed no remorse. They seemed to be proud of what they did. They were both narcissistic, as evidenced by their belief that they thought they were smarter than the cops, and they thought they were above the law. The brothers' bond and symbiotic relationship was not a healthy one, but it was the only one they knew. By the way, talking about their past abuse does not excuse them from their actions. They absolutely knew what they were doing was wrong, and they chose to do it anyway. Although in this case, their actions are inexplicably cruel.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
The state charged the brothers with more than 50 counts each of murder, rape, kidnapping, sodomy, burglary, and robbery. The trial began on September 5, 2002. Over the course of 8 weeks, 97 witnesses testified, mostly for the prosecution, and 50 pieces of evidence were admitted into trial. However, the most important witness was H.G., who recounted in vivid, grisly detail the rapes and executions of all four victims on the night of December 14th. As a primary means of defense, the brothers turned on each other. Neither showed any remorse. Throughout the trial, Reginald Carr was seen smirking and actually blowing kisses at the witnesses testifying against him. More than once, he was removed from the courtroom. At one point, both his hands and feet were shackled after he had deliberately rubbed up against the leg of the female prosecuting attorney. On November 5, 2002, after 14 hours of deliberation, the jury found Reginald and Jonathan Carr guilty. Both brothers were convicted of nearly all 113 counts against them, including kidnapping, robbery, rape, 4 counts of capital murder, and 1 count of first-degree murder. The brothers were each sentenced to death for the 4 capital murders, as well as being sentenced to life in prison with decades to serve before being eligible for parole for the murder of Ann Walenta. The Carr brothers did not react at the sentencing. However, their lawyers immediately appealed. The Kansas Supreme Court vacated the death penalties in both cases. It held that the instructions used in the Carr's sentencing violated the Constitution and that the brothers were entitled to separate sentencing trials. However, in 2015, the Attorney General of Kansas appealed that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in January 2016, the United States Supreme Court, in an 8-1 ruling, reinstated the death sentences, overturning the Kansas Supreme Court, deciding that neither the jury instructions, which were challenged by the Carr's legal counsel, nor the combined sentencing proceedings violated the Constitution. After the trial, it was discovered that Reginald Carr had been erroneously released from prison before he and his brother went on their crime spree. This happened because of botched paperwork within the prison system. The families of the victims sued the state for negligence, and they won. The families used some of the funds to create scholarships and grants as a tribute to those they had lost. During the trial, H.G. became close with Andrew Schreiber, the carjacking and kidnapping victim of the Carrs, forming a bond over the shared horror that they experienced at the hands of the brothers. After 2 years of dating, the couple married in 2004 and have two children. I am both amazed and happy that there can be such a bright ending in such a dark tale. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review. Follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen 1 week early and ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. By supporting them, you help us offer the show for free. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey. Next week on Killer Psyche, the Lonely Hearts Killers. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Edited by Joshua Morales and Maxwell Carney, with research and editing assistance from Ann Liu. Our senior audio producer is Tom Monahan. Renee Levesque is production manager. And Haley Mandelberg is production coordinator. Brandon Clark and Lindsay Whistler are production assistants, and the line producer is Oscar Guido. Our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort and Marsha Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.